Genesis chapter 10 and verse 5. From the sons of Japheth, the coastland people spread in their lands, each with his own language, by their clans, in their nations. Chapter 10 and verse 20. These are the sons of Ham, by their clans, their languages, their lands, and their nations. Chapter 10 and verse 31. These are the sons of Shem, by their clans, their languages, their lands, and their nations. These are the clans of the sons of Noah, according to their genealogies, in their nations. And from these the nations spread abroad on the earth after the flood. From these people, these three sons of Noah, the whole earth was dispersed. At last, the people of the world are walking in obedience to the commands of God, that they be fruitful and multiply, teem on the earth and multiply in it. At last, the peoples of the earth are heeding the word of God, that they should be fruitful and multiply and proceed to spread through all the earth. Sadly, no. It would appear from chapter 10 that everything is going well. But there is a surprise as you read that chapter. After all, these are the sons of Noah. Three brothers descended from one man, whose sons and grandsons we discover have their own languages. Isn't that a strange thing? I imagine that at least most of you here speak the language of your father and grandfather and great-grandfather. Perhaps there are one or two who, through reasons of living in a different country, have changed their language and adopted a new one. But most of us could trace our language back at least a number of generations. And yet we discover in this 10th chapter, as the descendants of Noah are named, that they are spread abroad but speaking different languages. When we add to that the fact that these different languages developed somewhere between 101 years after the flood and a maximum of 340 years after the flood, it becomes even more surprising. In the space of somewhere in the region of 239 years, we know that it was during the life of Peleg that something dramatic happened, because chapter 10 and verse 25 tells us that. To Eber were born two sons. The name of the one was Peleg, for in his days the earth was divided. And we saw in our last study in this book of Genesis that that division was a reference to the languages and the separation of the peoples dispersed in their nations. Something happened during the life of Peleg, who lived between 101 years after the flood and 340 years. For those of you who are interested in such things, it's worthy of note that Noah outlived Peleg by 10 years. So this dramatic event was during Noah's life. Furthermore, it seems likely that this event occurred earlier on in Peleg's life rather than later. And the reason I say that is that we know that Terah, mentioned in verse 26 or 25 and 26 of chapter 11, is the father of Abraham. We know that Terah was born 222 years after the flood. So about a third of the way through Peleg's life, Terah was born. And we also know that by the time he left Ur of the Chaldees, Ur of the Chaldeans was an established, settled civilization. And so it seems likely that since that is the case, that what led to the spread of the nations and therefore the establishing of the Chaldeans as a people group with their own language, with a settled civilization, the event that was the catalyst for that movement and spread and settlement must have been some time before. And so we're not looking at a huge time lapse between the flood, between Noah's sons coming off the ark, having sons of their own, and these family groups developing, and this event which drove people to move out from that region to other places. And chapter 11 and verses 1 through 9 really is a commentary on the fact that the people who disembarked from the ark and their descendants were really no better than the people who had lived before the flood. Their hearts were the same. They were sinners like those who had gone before. Not all is well in the world. And indeed, we get a hint of that in the opening words of this chapter. We're told that the whole earth had one language and the same word. So chronologically, we're going back to the beginning of chapter 10, okay? Chapter 10 has given us an overview of an expanse of time, not thousands of years, but a few hundred years, as the lineages of Shem, Ham and Japheth are described for us. Chapter 11 takes us back in time to the days of Peleg, somewhere perhaps 150, 200 years following the flood. Now the whole earth had one language and the same words. And as the people migrated, the ESV says, from the east, it would be better to translate it eastward, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. Now, why do I emphasize that and seek to present a more accurate translation? The reason is that the term eastward, particularly in these earlier chapters of Genesis, has a particular meaning. It's a weighty word. It's not simply telling us geographically the people moved in a certain direction. What it's telling us is that spiritually people were moving in a certain direction. And that direction is away from God, not towards God. Why do I say that? Well, you go back to the very early chapters of Genesis. You go back to the Garden of Eden. You go back to the fall of Adam and Eve. You go back to the shame of their disobedience against God. You go back to the curse upon the serpent and the judgment upon Adam and Eve. You go back to the time when God banished them from the garden that was the visible evidence of his presence among mankind, their banishment from his presence, and we are told that God set a guard there on the eastern side of the Garden of Eden, so that they could not again enter into that place. He drove out the man, we're told in chapter 3 and verse 24, and at the east of the Garden of Eden, he placed the cherubim and a flaming sword that turned every way to guard the way of the tree of life. Furthermore, after Cain has killed his brother Abel, and God accosts him and challenges him with regard to the murder of his brother, and then pronounces his judgment upon Cain, Cain is sent away to wander in the wilderness. And the direction that he takes is eastward, away from Eden. Cain went away from the presence of the Lord and settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden. And now we discover that the people migrate following the flood, and they migrate eastward. They're doing what Cain did. They are going away from the presence of the Lord, as it were. It's far more significant than simply a geographical statement. It is a spiritual statement. Far from being obedient to God in being fruitful and multiplying and filling the earth, they may well be fruitful, they may well be multiplying, but they're moving away from God as a body of people. And they find a plain in the land of Shinar, and they settle there. And then they say, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And Moses comments that they had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. They were in an oil-rich territory. In a plain, there were no stones with which to build. They made bricks. They didn't produce mortar, but they used the bitumen from the tar pits that abounded. And having discovered this method of construction, they say, in a very determined tone, as the Hebrew demonstrates, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens. And let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth. Now there are three things that these people are determined to do. They're determined that they will build a city with a tower that reaches to heaven. They are determined to make a name for themselves. And they are determined to settle together in one place. Now all of these three things are significant. They are significant as evidences of the state of their hearts in rebellion against God. You may recall from our study in chapter 10 that we were already prepared for what was to take place in Babel. For we're told there that Cush, the son of Ham, fathered Nimrod. We're told that he was the first on the earth to be a mighty man. We traced that back to the earlier passage in chapter 6, where the mighty men of the earth were those who were mighty, great in their wickedness, in their rebellion against God. After the flood, he is the first one to be marked by this character. And he made a name for himself, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. We observed again that this was not a positive remark on Nimrod's warrior status in the army of God, but rather it was a remark on Nimrod's rebellion against God. In fact, his name itself means "I will rebel," or "let us rebel." And we're told that the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, among other places. And here we are at a city that is being built, and a tower that has become infamous by its name. The rebel king leads the way for the people who have disembarked from the ark, and he is building a city with a tower that will reach to heaven. It's a demonstration of this people's rebellion against God. For in all of it, they are determined that by their own strength, by their own might, by their own ingenuity and development of technology, they will be able to elevate themselves to God. This was, after all, what brought Adam and Eve to their downfall. They would be like God in their own way, rather than in the image of God in God's way. They determined to take matters into their own hands, and this is what this people are doing. They are determined that they will build a tower whose top was in the heavens. Not that we should necessarily think that they believed they could literally build a tower and climb it and enter into a place called heaven. But the thrust of what they are saying amounts to a rebellion against God and his ways, and a determination to pursue their lives in their own ways. And in fact, this place, Babel, is the place that goes by another name, the Greek name, Babylon, a name that throughout the scriptures is symbolic of rebellion against God. Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens. And let us make a name for ourselves. They wanted to be famous. They wanted to set their mark upon the earth in such a way that they would be, as it were, immortal. Instead, they have become infamous. But their heart attitude, which is displayed in these words, is one that is repeated over and over and over again in the scriptures. Let me give you a couple of examples. Take, for example, the story of Ruth. You remember how Ruth the Moabite followed her mother-in-law Naomi back to Bethlehem and to the people of Israel. And there she settled, and there she gleaned in the fields of a close relative of theirs, a man named Boaz. You'll remember perhaps how Naomi advised her and instructed her in asking Boaz for help, because of their poverty and their predicament, and that Ruth did this and approached Boaz on the threshing floor after the harvest. But he disclosed to her that there was someone else who had a first refusal, if you like, on what Naomi was encouraging Boaz to do, which was to redeem the property of her husband that she had had to sell. That he would maintain the name of her husband for future generations. You may recall that Boaz determined to find out whether this closer relative would be willing to go through with the deal and to protect the inheritance of Naomi. Well, in doing so, this man risked losing his own status, his own name in the community, in preserving the name of Elimelech, Naomi's husband, if he were to marry Ruth. And he refused to do so. Chapter 4 describes that for us, and I'm not going to read the whole chapter, but he essentially refuses to buy the land because in doing so he would also have to marry Ruth, raise an heir for her, and in doing so risk his own name. He wasn't prepared to do so, and so he remains, interestingly enough, nameless. He seeks to preserve his name by not doing his duty, and he remains nameless. Whereas Boaz does his duty, and he is famous in all history for having done so. In the New Testament, Jesus tells the story of a man who was wealthy, and a poor beggar who sat at his gate. We know that both these men died, and that the wealthy man went to hell, and that the poor man went to heaven. Interestingly enough, in the midst of that story, the poor man, his name we know. It was Lazarus. And the wealthy man, well, all we know of him is that he was the rich man. He thought he was everything, and that the man at his gate was nothing. But we know nothing about him apart from his wealth. Whereas we know that the other man had a name. It was Lazarus. Now those are just examples, and there are others that we could look at, but the desire to preserve a name for ourselves inevitably means losing it. Now the reality is that what these people were doing was not simply wanting a name. They wanted a presence. They wanted immortality. They wanted something more. And it was expressed in this statement, "Let us make a name for ourselves." Throughout the Old Testament, on the other hand, there is only one who makes a name for himself, and that is God. There are times when he chooses to make a name for someone else, but it is always he who makes the name. It is always he who elevates the person, who distinguishes them from among their people. The only one who takes it upon themselves to make a name for themselves and succeed is God himself. He is the one who is described as making a name for himself in the scriptures. And indeed, what Jesus instructs us to do, far more than making a name for ourselves, far more than seeking to establish ourselves and preserve ourselves and make ourselves immortal, Jesus says that we should seek to lose ourselves. We should seek to make ourselves of no account. He advises that we shouldn't think too greatly of ourselves. And that indeed, in doing this, in losing ourselves, we will find ourselves. In being willing to lose our lives among the masses, we will gain life and immortality. It is the contrary picture to that which is presented to us in the city and tower that bears the name Babel. And then the third thing that we observe is that this people are determined not to be dispersed over the face of the whole earth. This is in direct contrast to that which they were purposed to do. They are determined that they will stay in one place, whereas God has told them, fill the earth. They are determined that they will not be dispersed, when God has told them that they must disperse. And so in these ways we see this people demonstrate not their allegiance to God, not their willingness to obey God, not the fact that humanity has learned its lesson through the flood, but rather that the same heart that had governed the people before the flood now governed the people after the flood. They were still rebellious. They were still focused on their own selfish ambitions. They were still rebels against the living God who had so graciously shown mercy to this world by preserving Noah and his sons upon the ark. And then we're told the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of man had built. There's an irony here. These men were purposed to build a city and a tower with its top into the heavens. And the all-seeing, all-knowing God is described as stooping down to see what puny man is up to. You know, the picture we should have in our minds is that of someone stooping down to look at the ants running around, busily doing their business, determined to build their hill to the heavens. What a pathetic picture. This is how we are to see these goings on here. The Lord came down. He had to stoop. He had to strain his eyes. What are they doing? And the Lord said, look, behold, they are one people, and they have one language. And this that they are doing, this is only the beginning of what they will do. Nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. Let us not misunderstand what God is saying here. He is not saying that this people is omnipotent, that they have the power literally to do anything that they want. What he is suggesting here is that the state of mankind before the fall, before the flood rather, could be repeated. That in the unity of their language and of their locality, these people could flourish in their wickedness, so that whatever they determined to do in rebellion against God, they would accomplish. That was the state of mankind before the flood. That's the picture that we have in chapter 6. Remember what was said there. The sons of God saw the daughters of men were attractive, and they took as their wives any that they chose. The idea here is that they could do whatever they wanted to do, and they did whatever they wanted to do. In the face of God, their wickedness was so great. Well, this is the idea that we're being drawn back to here. Look at these people. Look at what they're doing. This is only the beginning of their fist raised in rebellion against God. Unless we do something, God says, in his triune person, they will continue to rebel, and they will continue to grow greater and greater in their wickedness. And just as they had determinedly said, come, let us build, God says, come, let us go down, and confuse their language, so that they may not understand one another's speech. They are determined not to do the will of God. They are determined to stay in one place and to make a name for themselves. God is determined that they will disperse through all the earth. He will make a name for himself. And so the Lord dispersed them from there over the face of all the earth, and they left off building the city. The sons of Japheth were the coastland people who spread in their lands, each with his own language, by their clans in their nations. The sons of Ham, by their clans, their languages, their lands, their nations. The sons of Shem, by their clans, their languages, their lands, their nations. Not by their choice, but by God's choice, they were dispersed. And so the name that has become infamous in history, Babel, was given to that place, that city and that tower. For there the Lord confused the language of all the earth, and from there the Lord dispersed them over the face of all the earth. They were determined to go their way, and they were determined to make themselves like God in their power and achievements. They were destined for heaven by their own works. But God would have us know that there is only one way to heaven, and that is by submission to him and his will. Yes, Babel or Babylon has become the picture, the symbol in the Bible for wickedness, for man's rebellion against God, and it achieves its pinnacle then in the book of Revelation, where Babylon is pictured at war with God. But Babylon is destroyed. It's vanquished, and a heavenly city is established. These people are determined, like men through all the ages of history, to make a name for themselves. But there is only one name by which we can be saved and brought near to God, and that is through the Lord Jesus Christ, who is the great victor in the Bible, And again, in the book of Revelation, we see the pinnacle of that picture presented to us as the Lamb sits upon the throne of God and brings about the purposes of the Creator. And here are a people who are determined to be united together in one place. But God disperses them and confuses them. But it is God's plan to make one people. It is God's plan to make one nation who will honour him and serve him. And in the plan of God, the confusion and the dispersion that is described in chapter 11 is reversed for us in the New Testament through the work of Jesus Christ, whose death on the cross accomplishes the salvation of people from every tribe and every tongue and every nation upon the earth. The descendants of Ham and Shem and Japheth will be gathered together as one people in the city of God. But it will be in God's way and by God's devising, not in our way and by our devising. The arrogance of man is condemned in these verses. And we are instructed to submit to God, and he will save us. And so it is that we come again and again and again in our studies in the Bible, doesn't matter where you open the page, we come back to Jesus as the solution. The solution for the problem of man, whose heart is corrupt and desperately wicked, is to be found in Jesus Christ, who died to save sinners. If we will submit to him and take his name, then he will give us the inheritance that he has won for his people in a new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells.